I'm very strong on principles and ethics, and I want processes to operate properly because that's the only way you get reliability. But then trusting them to do that without completely micromanaging. I pay them well. I think if I can get people who will then provide me with the freedom of choice, then I want to reward that. It's a good investment rather than doing it myself and being stuck at the wheel the whole time.
You are listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent for real estate industry sales professionals, property managers, and leaders. Each episode, we bring you the best minds in business and real estate to help you list more, sell more, and elevate your results. To connect with all things Elite Agent, including the latest news, coaching, and features, subscribe at our website, eliteagent.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Elevate Podcast, where we delve into some of the most interesting minds in business and in real estate for the very best tips and strategies for you to implement to elevate your business. I'm Samantha McLean, editor of Elite Agent, and once again this week joined by Mark Edwards.
It's so awesome to be back.
Well, this podcast is by request.
By request.
By request from one of our readers, actually. He contacted me on LinkedIn and said, I really love the podcast, really love the people you have on it, but seriously, you got to have my boss on.
How can you refuse that one?
Yeah, how can you say no to that one? And I mean, look, it's Wayne Marriott is not someone that's been unknown to us over the years.
He's a local gentleman to us, isn't he?
He is. He's actually, well, pretty much down the road. And, you know, obviously Crow's Nest is not that far from North Sydney, and we've walked past his office multiple times. And it's known for being, you know, like one of the hubs of Crow's Nest in Sydney. Also, we know Wayne from, I mean, he's very passionate about learning. So just about every conference that we've ever been to in Sydney, you know,
Wayne.
He's a tall guy. You see Wayne's head pop up.
It's a bit like him and Ewan Morton. The two of them are just like
just
sort of
really,
tower
really
above
tall. Yeah. Actually, I want to have a bit of a height competition because I think Matt Steinway's up there too.
in height. Get a lineup.
Yeah, so Steve said, got to get my boss on. Now, Wayne is a little bit shy. He's a little bit like Ben Collier, and it took us a bit of coaxing to get him into the podcast room, but boy, I'm glad we did. Some really great stories there. So Wayne has a background not too dissimilar to mine and yours, actually. He sort of came out of IBM. He was a sales engineer, got made redundant, and then thought, what am I going to do with this money? Not that we ever had that much money. But Wayne decided to open up a real estate office, and he's been in business now for 27 years.
And as you said, he's been one of those fixtures in the Lower North Shore. Probably not the big recognisable names that you actually see, you know, sort of plastered all around the traps, but definitely been one of those agencies that have held their own for a very, very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a story about how Wayne started up with no knowledge of real estate to having a business with longevity, to having such a low turnover of staff, and we're going to like really unpack why staff don't leave Marriott Lane Real Estate, which is really interesting. Wayne's superpower is negotiation, and towards the end of this podcast, you're going to hear Wayne actually go through some scripts and dialogues that he uses in negotiation. So obviously we've had lots of stuff on negotiation in the last 12 months in the podcast. We've had Ben talk about his negotiation superpowers. We've had Pancho, you know, with his Harvard stuff.
You've had Josh Teslin in here talking about his, you know, sort of Energizer Bunny approach.
Yeah, and now you're going to get another angle. So really interesting, and also for leaders, I guess, Wayne was a big fan of the E-Myth, the Michael Gerber book about replacing yourself. And so Wayne's actually a national hurdling champion.
Hurdling?
Hurdling. Like, he's a national athletics champion, and the way he set his business up allows him to go and compete around the world in these hurdling championships. So your mouth's open, so you didn't know that.
No, I didn't.
Anyway, I took notes. There was lots of notes. It was a long chat.
I am going to have to go back and reread over these notes. And a good way to get your hands on these notes.
EliteAgentElevate.com.
Yeah, there we go. And
just rolls off
yeah,
now.
I know, it does. A bit of a shameless plug there. EliteAgentElevate.com. And if you actually want to get all of the show notes packaged up for you each and every month for the podcasts that have happened during that month, become a pro member.
Yeah.
You'll get not only the show notes, but you'll also get our award-winning magazine, Elite Agent Magazine, and a whole lot of other stuff.
Absolutely.
And so what's the best way of being able to become a pro member?
EliteAgent.com/pro.
All right. So there's all the plugs.
Yep.
There's all the information.
Definitely listen to this one, or at least download the show notes.
Absolutely.
And we'll catch you next week.
Cheers. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the podcast, Wayne Marriott.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, it's good to have another local real estate agent come and visit our office, because Mark and I often walk past your office in Crow's Nest, and it's very, very distinctive because of those beautiful Vitrine Media displays in your window. Do they attract a lot of people?
Yes, I've always wanted to have a great window. Some of the thinking right back at the start was the bigger the window, the harder you had to work to fill it.
Yep.
So if you have a small window, it sort of puts a cap on expectations. Yeah, I liked having the vitrine displays. I'm a great fan of having static displays as the main part of it, because I look at other agents' windows and see the thing flashes over just as you're reading.
Just as you get to the property
that you want to see. So then you have to wait 10 minutes to see it come up again. And I've got a couple of TV sets as well, just for informational things, but the properties I just like to be static.
Yeah. For people that perhaps, you know, are sort of thinking, you know, there's a lot of talk, is the shop front still going to be alive in a few years' time, or is it not? Like, I think your office is actually a great example of how people will flock to a great-looking real estate office. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm a fan of it. It's costly to be on a prominent corner. I think it's the best site for real estate office in Crow's Nest, and it's the best, you know, looking office. So I just think so. Well, that's where to start. Start at the, you know, looking the best,
yeah.
And then, you know, that at least says you're trying.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you're here because one of your team members is an avid listener of the podcast, and he got in touch with me and he said, look, I love all your guests, but really you've got to get my boss in. So we're delighted that you would join us. And I'd love to know about your journey into real estate to start with, because you don't just have the passion for real estate, but you're also an athlete, I found out.
Yes, I'll tell you about the real estate start. I've only really had three jobs in my life. I worked in having all this technology around here with microphones and things. That was my first place I worked. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, which is starting to date me.
Yeah.
I worked at a sound company in Melbourne that provided rock and roll equipment to all the local bands. And
awesome.
From Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs to AC/DC and Skyhawks and everyone.
Yeah.
And it was during school and holidays, weekends. I was there just all the time for about 7 years, finally finishing university, and then joined IBM.
Did you meet the bands?
Yes.
Who is your favourite band back then?
Well, from professionalism, there's the band Little River Band were easily the best organised.
Yeah.
I used to have long conversations with Red Simons. He and I both went to Melbourne University, and I saw them play, you know, in the quadrangle there.
Yeah.
So I had great conversations with him. But a lot of it was the roadies. You got to really get, you know, with the bands behind the scenes. But we can talk on for,
it
was really, it was great. I could go to any concert for free for years. So I, you know, got to see meet the Bee Gees and
wow. You
know, all these sort of people. It was great.
Amazing. So what made you go from that sort of an exciting career to IBM?
Part of it was just the unreliability of the business. People didn't pay their bills. There was a lot of drugs around, and it just made people, you know, difficult to deal with. So going to the other extreme of joining IBM I just felt it'd be a safer bet. But it's funny, the people that I was still dealing with, like Michael Kudinski and Michael Chugg and all those sorts of people, they're still around. They're still running the business now. They're all in their 70s.
Yep. Yeah.
And still running the whole show, even today.
Yeah, interesting. So, and then you went from IBM into real estate. So what were you doing at IBM?
I started as a systems engineer and then went into sales. I was there 14 years.
Yeah, well.
They had a huge downsizing where they were paying people to leave back in 1991, and I left. I didn't really have a plan.
Yeah.
And I just felt I wanted to run my own business, and I looked at what options I had. Like restaurants seemed way too hard.
Yeah.
Laundromats seemed way too boring.
Terrible hours.
Real estate was anything that I thought I could do, you know, low entry qualifications. And so I actually bought a real estate office as pretty much the first thing I did in real estate.
Oh, okay. Mm. Interesting. And so what were the early days like? It was a Richardson Rent office, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. So what was it like, you know, going into real estate for the first time? Like, can you recall your first sort of few weeks, months in the business?
I really didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have a license, because you needed to be in the industry for 2 years to get one. So I employed a licensee. It sounds funny, but the first 20 years were the hardest.
Yeah, the first 20.
And seriously, I've been doing it 27 now.
Yeah.
And I've only really felt that I've got comfortable where I'm not looking over my shoulder about, you know, are we going to be all right? You know, when's the next downturn coming and how am I going to handle it? Yeah, it was very hard, to be frank.
Yeah. Mm. So you've grown from being a solo office with hiring someone as your licensee to growing to 18 people with two of them overseas. So tell me a bit about the growth journey that you've had over the years.
Mm. When you start an office from scratch, you have to sell properties. It came with 11 managements.
So, a lot of 11.
11 managements.
Lucky 11.
of course, when you've got that number of managements, it's just work with no money, really. Mm. So you have to sell. And it was a very slow start. I actually sold one property a month for the first 6 months. In the next 6 months, I'd sold two properties a month, so 18 in the first year. I got a big payout from IBM, and I spent most of that in the first 8 months, I think.
Yep.
So it was a tough beginning, finding one salesperson, then making that start working, then a second. It was just one step forward, one back for a while, then two steps forward and one back. For a long time, sales was about two-thirds of the business, and rentals gradually grew. I didn't focus on it because I had to focus on sales. And it just gradually came together. It wasn't overnight success at any level. Something that changed my life was Neil Genman.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a lot of
controversy
about Neil.
Yeah.
But I learned a great deal from Neil. So I've been a big fan of training ever since.
Yeah.
And I think it gave me a process to work to. And that sort of narrowed all my thinking down to, if I do these things, you know, if we prospect, we follow up, we, you know, have a process to selling, it'll come together and it'll be reliable. And it gradually came about, but slow. And getting the right people is always the tough thing as well.
I would 100% agree with you. Mm. You know, in any entrepreneurial journey, the right people can make or break you, I think.
Yeah.
In the early days, I imagine you were selling quite a bit, and you're still a selling principal now, aren't you?
No, not really.
Not really?
I know that you were going to ask me about a book that you mentioned that your favourite influential book. It's time to talk about that at this instant because the book is The E-Myth by Michael Gerber. I don't know whether most people have heard of it, but I'd still recommend people dip back into the past and read it. What it was all about is whether the difference between running a business and having a job. Mm. And most people in business actually just have a job. And a business is where you have other people working for you. And once I understood that's what I wanted to do, have a team of people effectively doing things that I don't need to do anymore and hopefully better than I would ever do. And when you reach that point, the goal is to make yourself completely redundant. And it was always the dream, and it's really come to that sort of point where I don't sell real estate. I've got a very big property management business, but I've never rented out a property. I've never done a property inspection. So just having a good team, and that was the goal right from the start, to have a business.
What do you look for when you're recruiting someone into the team?
To be frank, I make a lot of mistakes.
We all do.
Yeah, it is the hardest thing in running a business. It's just getting the right people and keeping them. I think I've got it better now. It's just trying to look for qualities of people. You can teach people things, but you can't teach them, you know, the basic skills of negotiation and being engaging and so on. So the big point is actually when you get someone is then retaining them, not letting them drift away. My longest term salesperson is Stuart Howard. He's been with me 25 years of those 27 and a half.
Yep, that's a good marriage.
Yes, yeah. And Stephen, you mentioned the guy who recommended I come on here. He's been with me 4 years now.
Yeah.
I think he'll stay another 14 at least. I've got a property manager who's been with me 12 years. The next one's 9 years and so on. So I've really tried very hard to, when you get good people, keep them with you.
Yeah, absolutely. What advice would you give to other leaders such as yourself on being able to keep people? Because churn in the industry is a bit of an issue. Like what you're describing there with your team is highly unusual, you know, where you're able to retain people for great lengths of time. I think I can think of a few other people I've interviewed that have got similar. We can even tell from our subscriber base that people move quite regularly. So if you had to sort of give some advice to somebody who is, you know, who had the problem of people coming and going, what would you say?
I think it's multi-facets to it. One is not micromanaging. I try and let people have their head. I'm very strong on principles and ethics, and I want processes to operate properly because that's the only way you get reliability. But then trusting them to do that without completely micromanaging. I pay them well. I think if I can get people who will then provide me with the freedom of choice, then I want to reward that. It's a good investment rather than doing it myself and being stuck at the wheel the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
I've started traveling about 11 weeks a year.
Wow.
Any more than that, we get homesickness. We're way too much. So, but I just means that when I'm on away, I don't get phone calls. I don't have to sort of handle situations. I do talk to the office, but very rarely do I have to make decisions or do anything when I'm away. So I think that's worth rewarding people. I reward for success as well, because that aligns with what I want. For example, my property management people, two of them grossed, including super, about 140,000 last year, which most people would think, wow.
That's high, yeah.
But the, you know, the income they bring into the office, the number of properties they manage, the success of just keeping those people on board, I'm very grateful for that, to look after the property management asset. Everyone makes $100,000 in PM. I've got six senior property managers now.
I can hear the pencils of people writing, like Googling Marriott Lane right
How do I join
now.
That? Yeah.
How do I join?
Hmm.
Let's talk about property management for a moment, because you said you started with 11 properties. The business came with 11, and now you've got, I think, nearly 1,000 or over 1,000.
Yeah, just up to 1,000, yeah.
Tell me about how your approach to growing the rent roll, aside from people, obviously, because people are a big part of your equation, right?
I've become opinionated about property management, and I like property management a lot because it's a process that you can repeat. And I've got a booklet that we hand out to prospective clients, and effectively it summarizes exactly what good property management's all about. There's thousands of them around, so all of my competitors could have easily have got one of these books and understood what we do. And nothing's a mystery in there that of what good property management is. And I find it remarkable that we are so good at doing it and others aren't. And you've got to say, well, why? Because there's no debate about what you do every day in property management. You return phone calls, you visit properties at regular intervals, you organize repairs swiftly, you increase rent at regular times and all that sort of thing. It's just there. So the mystery is, why don't others do it as well as we do, so that we're not standing out completely at another level compared to those people? And that's where the success has been. And I put it to a few things. One is portfolio versus alternatives like pod and task management processes. I'm a huge fan of portfolio.
Yeah. So that's one person in charge of...
One person in charge of the entire relationship. And when you present the alternatives to a client, you're saying, look, I can get a team of people who are all really good at what they do. You know, this person, letting clerk, they know tenants well, they know how to interview tenants, they know how to check applications. They're perfect at that job. I've got another person who does routines, that's all they do, so they're fantastic at it. And so you can sort of sell it of specialization. Then you describe portfolio, saying, well, one person does all these things and they holistically understand you, the property, the tenant, and then present the question, okay, which one would you prefer? 95 out of 100 will prefer portfolio. They're just like one phone call rather than six different people at different times calling. So I find it really odd that people would set up a system that most clients regard as inferior to portfolio. The other thing that's most people don't realize is that tasks are boring. You imagine your whole life just doing property inspections, going there and criticizing the tenant. Could you tidy that up, please? No, we're going to have to take some of your bond because of X. And the whole life is spent visiting properties, and the only time you meet tenants there, they're probably under stress and angry at what you're saying to them. And you leave. You ain't sick at that.
Mm.
Whereas portfolio, you've got properties that you're dealing with over the years, you know everything about it, you know the neighbours, you know the tenant over a long period of time, the owners, you get Christmas cards and gifts from these people. And that's just what life is. It's relationships and it's variety. And so that's how I believe I can keep people. And I'm just insistent. You know, sometimes I get, for those people who were taking my number before, I meet senior people in real estate, in property management in particular, and they don't want to work Saturdays anymore. They don't want to go and do inspections anymore. I didn't have to go and see new tenants on Saturdays. I'd like to sit in the office. And they're just not suitable for my office. It just on portfolio.
Yeah.
That's the way it is.
Yeah.
But I believe people enjoy the job more.
I can sort of see too that, yeah, the reason that I think some people shy away from portfolio because they're worried that people will leave. But if you can sort out that problem of the person leaving that they want to stay, then, you know, keeping their job.
That's a big fear. You know, if you have someone where all your clients love them, they have the relationship more than the office. And if they leave, they could potentially drag a huge numbers of people with them. Yes, it's a danger. The solution is I make it so that there's no reason for them to leave. If one of my people leave, I want them to leave the industry.
Yeah.
If they want to go and be a
sound engineer,
and rock and roll, or yeah. You know, a passion for take up painting or whatever they want to do, I'd be delighted for them. But I don't want them to leave to another office. And so I want them to know that I'm a nice boss. The job is interesting. They're paid above the odds. So someone would have to really pay a lot to buy them out of my office.
Yeah.
And that's my protection.
Yeah, interesting. What about the sales side of the business? Some people would say in 30 years the sales world has changed a lot in some ways with technology and so forth, and in some ways it hasn't really changed much because of the human-to-human connection. So what do you think has been successful for you and for your team in the sales world over the years?
What I've found in sales over the years is that all my competitors now are good. In the past, you'd have some really hopeless people out there where, oh, good, I'm going up against X, I'll win. Now I find every single office around has got good people in it, working to good processes and practices. And that's why I started liking property management, because it wasn't, the world was completely different there, where my competitors weren't as good as us, and demonstrably. Yeah, it's a dilemma. What we've done, though, that's made a big difference over the last few years, and the team are really getting, you know, stronger and better results, is take some of the processes that I've put together in property management and really just defining to people, this is the best way to sell real estate. There's not a lot of argument now about the best way to sell real estate. You know, in the past there was debates about, do you auction, do you not, do you charge for marketing or don't you, and you know, open for inspections versus private appointments and all this sort of thing. There's a huge amount of debate about what's the best way to do real estate. With the advent of the legislation taking away a lot of the practices, the internet has made a massive difference in the way you show market properties. I think it's now reached a point where there's almost everyone agrees on the best way to sell a property. There isn't massive debate where someone says, I do it completely different to everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because, you know, there are some people out there who would sort of say, okay, we can't systemize the sales process the same way. But even I've come around to a way of thinking that you can put processes and checklists in place for pretty much everything.
Yeah. Selling is a process. In fact, the marketing booklet we have is just says that selling is a process. And here is our process.
Yeah. We had a bit of an interesting market last year where I think even you said in one of your blog posts that I read is that it was a tale of two markets last year. Like in the beginning of the year, everyone sort of left the building. And then in the second half of the year, everyone came back kind of thing. So given that you've seen a few cycles, how did you handle the first half of last year?
First of all, yeah, I have seen a lot of them. And I'm phlegmatic about markets. I worry about things I can change. I don't worry about things that, like a market, it's just the way it is. And I employ more people in that time rather than less. I think keeping costs where they should be. I don't budget, to be frank, but just having the resources to see through things. That's why the first 20 years were hard, because at times you didn't have those resources to really carry through without worrying. It's doing the regular things. Sort of prospecting works. You've got to make, you know, the more telephone calls you make, the more business you get. So I didn't stress out. I just don't worry about markets anymore. I observe markets.
Yeah. What about attracting buyers at the moment? Like a lot of people are talking about things like off-market at the moment versus, well, there are some people that sort of say there's no such thing as off-market because your property is either on the market or it's not. But what do you find is attracting the most interest in properties at the moment?
Yeah, I haven't bought into off-market. It's not part of our process. So we don't really want to try and process that up.
Yep.
I believe that the best way to get a great price is competition, and auction's the best way to sort out competition.
Yeah.
So I would rather open the property to the widest possible audience, give it time to breathe, which is not selling it the first day to anyone, and then determining whether you've got the legs of competition to have an auction, or if you have got the other two scenarios where there's just one buyer that's way better than the others, or you've got pretty low competition for a property, then you move into a private treaty negotiation before the auction. That's the process that I believe gives you the best opportunity to achieve a premium price for a client. And I think trying to go off market and find that one buyer and match them up with no evidence about what other competition there would be for it is probably doing the wrong thing by the client, unless that's what the client wants, where the client says, I don't mind if I get a lower price, I just want a price and I want it to be private, I want it to be done in this way, then I'd say, well, that's fine. But I don't really see that as something I want to do to systemize.
Yeah. Let's talk about your life outside of real estate. So I did hint that we dug up the fact that you're actually a champion hurdler, like you're a champion athlete. How did you get involved in that?
I did it at school. And then once I left university and went into real estate, I didn't do a lot else. Saturdays, of course, were locked up with opens, and you know, the office has always been open 7 days a week. So I really ignored a lot of my other things. I'm some wonderful kids to look after, and so sport and golf and the rest of it just went out of my life. And in my 40s, I took up over 35s soccer, or football as I prefer to call it. The only problem is I'd never played it when I was young, and I was pretty hopeless. And eventually I decided, why don't I try something that I used to be good at, and I took up Masters Athletics when I turned 51.
Yeah, wow.
And it took 5 years to actually get to a peak. You know, it was getting better for 5 years. And then once you reach your peak, then you head backwards as you get older. And I took up hurdles because I'm a good sprinter, but not great. Like, I'm 65 now, and I can run 100 metres in about 14 seconds.
But I reckon you'd beat me.
But the best in the world do it in about 12 and a half or more. You know, yeah. So, but not many of the really great sprinters are silly enough to do hurdles. So I do that. And I've been the national champion now for the last 5 or 6 years in a row. And I go to the World Championships every year, which is one of the trips. And this year it's Toronto. Last year it was in Poland.
Yeah, wow.
So it's just something that keeps me fit, and it scares the life out of me. The hurdles are still as heavy as they were when I was a kid, and you don't really want to hit them at my age, but I still do them.
They say too that, you know, there's a big correlation between elite sports and business. So what has your sporting adventures taught you about business?
Oh, practice makes perfect. It's just you can't do anything well unless you think about it a lot and work at it. So I'm always thinking about the business, and I don't do a lot of the stuff anymore, as we've said, but I always, you know, what's next? I've got the list of things to do. Like, we've got 3D cameras now for all our property inspections, and we've got the people over in the Philippines. Integrating that into our business is a massive work. It's a lot harder than most people, I think, imagine. But all those are completely exciting. So it's I think, taking something on and just really working hard at it is just the same as what sports people do.
I guess you could also bring it down to a process as well, because becoming a good hurdler, you would have to be good at sprinting, you'd have to be good at jumping, you'd have to be good at, breaking stuff down.
Exactly.
Let's talk some advice for other people who are thinking about entering real estate or thinking about setting up their own business. So say someone's sitting there listening to this and feeling really inspired and wanted to open up their own business, what advice would you give them?
I don't think it's for everyone. It's hard. I think it's very fulfilling. I'm glad I did it. I would have been, looking back at this point in my life, if I'd just stayed at IBM and worked for others, I would have probably think I've let myself down. So it was something I thought it's something I wanted to do, even if it was going to be, and it is. I think training is the key to it all. I'm a huge attender of conferences. I'd recommend getting into a training sort of relationship and keep looking around whether there's other elements to it. I attend nearly every property management thing there is.
Yeah.
Ben White and the team at LPMA, huge fans of what they're doing.
Yeah.
I'm locking in to what Andrew Reese is doing in Spec Real Estate. I think the plans that organisation has got is going to transform real estate, in particular the rental side of things. So, I look for people to guide you. There's so much out there. Like, my PM book. You know, you send me an email, I reply to it, it's in the signature. So just read what other people have done. You don't reinvent stuff.
Real estate is one of those areas where there is so much information out there that it's not funny, but you're right. Yeah, still people don't actually go the action step. I also read somewhere that negotiation is kind of your secret superpower. What are a couple of negotiation tips that you could give rookies in the industry?
Something I've let myself down in, I should have written a book on negotiation, a real estate negotiation. For some reason, I just feel it. I know what to say next. So I'm not sure how transferable all of it is. There's books on it that I recommend. I won't sort of name titles so much here, but for example, you've got an owner who won't accept an offer, and it's a good offer. And many agents sort of get panicky and want to push the person into accepting it.
Mm.
And the client can become confused about, are they saying this because they just want an easy result, or are they saying this because it's what I should do? And because they're anxious, the agents, it comes across more as the former. You know, why are you pushing me so hard? You know, just give me some space at least. So my process is to just tell them what the offer is and let them think. I don't recommend it or not, but I position it. You know, this is an offer. We haven't had one like it. It's the best one we've seen today. I'm looking ahead for the next, what's in the pipeline of buyers. I can't see someone else who's prepared to pay this sort of figure. So we should be having a very good look at this one. So saying it's good, but I'm not telling you to take it. And then I would let them really talk it through, not interrupt, not push, not, you know, if they start going the wrong way. And if they end up saying, no, I don't want to take it, I'd say, great, okay, we'll get back to work. We'll find someone else and hang up. I actually like negotiating on the phone, believe it or not. Everyone says do it in place. I like phones.
Yeah.
Because I think you can actually hang up, regroup, and make another call.
Yeah.
So off message there for most of the people in real estate negotiation, but I love the phone. I then wait 15 minutes, and then I would call them back. And I tell them a story. So I'll use the real name. You probably won't ever hear this thing, but quite a long time ago, there's a guy called Bill Whitting owned a house, and we had it on the market for him, and we got a really good offer. He came into the office, and two of us, the two salespeople involved, were me and someone else, said that we thought it was a good offer. He said no, and we didn't push him to take it. He fired us. A few weeks later, he sold it with someone else for about $45,000, like it's more 5 or 6% less than we had. And he came into my office and was annoyed at me, and I said, Bill, I thought we told you it was a decent offer. And he said, well, you didn't tell me to take it. And I said, okay. All right. So I tell the story of Bill Whitting, and I say, look, sometimes I can be a bit subtle, but I just want you to know that that is a good offer that I presented there. I haven't called them back and told them to go away, but I just want to make sure you know that I think it is a good offer and it wouldn't be a bad decision to accept it. Still not telling them to take it.
But it just wouldn't be a bad decision. Yeah, that's so, good language.
So then very often they will say, okay, give me a minute. They hang up within a minute or two, they ring back and say, look, we'll take your offer. The whole message of that is using an example of someone who didn't listen to me, maybe because I was being a bit subtle, but now I'm coming a little bit stronger. I'm never going to have another Bill Whitting in my life where someone was going to say to me that I didn't tell you that it was a good offer. And it works 95 times out of 100. And the 5% where they say, no, I still don't want to take it. They say, it's on my back. I appreciate that you're thinking I should take this offer, but I'm going to go out on my own and say no. And I think that's a great result. That's a long story about negotiation, but a lot of it is the gaps between conversations. It's the subtlety of what you're saying. Do you want another one?
Yeah.
There's a lot you can learn from manipulators and people who, serial killers and and con men and so on, because they use negotiation to persuade people to do what they want to do. And so I think a lot of the skills in negotiation are exactly the same things, except we're doing it for good. One is a thing called false teaming. It's when you're talking to a purchaser and you start looking as though you're sounding a bit like you're working for them. So in this case, they've made an offer, and I'll say something along the lines of, yes, taking it in, but is a very good thing. The Chinese do it brilliantly. as though you've almost offended me.
Yeah.
And then say, look, I will tell the owner, but frankly, I can't recommend your offer. I think if they came to me and said, what should we do, Wayne? I'd say, look, I think we're better soldiering on. There'll be a better offer out there. But what I think we should do, this is the false teaming, what we should do is come back with a figure I can work with. I think it should be the best figure here. Let's not leave things on the table. And then I'll go to the owner and position it that way. That's our best effort for the owner. And I'll get you a yes or no decision. And that way, if the answer is no, you can go on, move on, find something else, or you get the property at a price you're prepared to pay. How about we do that? So using the word we, and here's a strategy that we're going to use to go to the owner. But of course, the whole strategy is to get a better price, something that the owner can have a good luck and maybe accept. Yeah, it's just that use of the subtle use of the language of when you swap into we, the sharp intake of breath when they make an offer, almost at times a wince where you say, gee, I thought you liked it. You didn't say anything except, yeah, the body language said, I'm not particularly happy about your offer. It's just little things like that where it persuades people.
Yeah, it's really interesting that what you said in the beginning there, the tuning in, because I think a lot of people fall into the trap of presenting an offer and then the vendor saying no, and then it becoming a bit adversarial rather than asking another question or giving people a breather or something like that, because there's always a reason behind the no. And then I think once you get adversarial in a negotiation, then you've kind of lost, haven't you?
Yeah, I had an agent say to me, I had an agent selling a property for me, and he actually used the words, you'd be mad not to take this.
Okay. You just told me I'm dumb.
Yeah, so yes. Sorry, I'm not taking it. And I got more later, because one other thing of advice when negotiations, let the other person talk. Don't interrupt. Let them finish the sentences. You know what they're going to say, but don't respond until they've said it completely and they feel heard. I hate seeing people interrupt someone who's trying to say something.
Yeah, listening skills are absolutely, totally, probably the most important thing, which actually that comes to my next question, actually. What is the most important skill a real estate agent or a leader can have today?
I think for real estate agents, just conversations. Having the ability to pick up the phone, knock on a door, get back to a potential buyer to see if they're a potential seller. It's just conversations.
You did mention a book a little bit earlier, The E-Myth. Are there any other resources or books or podcasts that have been particularly helpful to you?
I've read a lot of business books and I get bits and pieces from them. I think a lot of them, I think that's a good idea. And then I hope it just assimilates in there, because I don't often go and make a decision out of a book. I truly think the training stuff, just read, you know, the training resources, you know, just reading that and studying that and the scripts and dialogues. I think that's all you do.
So scripts and dialogues, do they still have a place now in today's modern world? Do you think people are using them too much, too little?
Oh, no, I think they're great. It's part of it. When something X happens, you say Y, you know, so someone makes you an offer.
Yeah.
You know, you should have something.
Something ready.
Ready to say. And if someone says, why is the owner selling? Oh, they're getting divorced. Or you know, something a bit better than that. Asking, and the ability to ask good questions. If you don't buy this property, what will you do? You know, just these open-ended questions. So there's, yeah, I think scripts and dialogues are absolutely essential to be good at what you do.
What do you see happening in the future of real estate, and how do you see your own team progressing?
Yeah, the old disruption question comes in there.
And I've got to ask that one.
I've got a valuable rent roll. Is it going to evaporate overnight? Yeah, I'm continually looking for things. I think the human touch is always going to be there. You know, good salespeople and good property managers will win out. But there's going to be a lot of technology coming in, that sort of self-repairing washing machines and things where it dials up and get someone to come and fix it and Amazon drop the part off next day or whatever. So I think a lot of that's going to happen. But I'm not fearful of it. I think there's such a lot of wonderful technology. Like we do videos at inspections. We've got the 3D cameras going now, you know, virtual tours of properties. So I can rent properties to people who have never seen them and things like that. I think there's so much out there that's going to change the industry. I think the offshoring is going to fundamentally change it too. Most of it will be to do things that we can't do now. And I think there's going to be the service will get better and better, and people who want the virtual assistants and things are going to be seen to be just not doing the whole job.
Look, I think property management's a really interesting place to be right now anyway, if all the signs point to young people preferring to rent rather than own. I think it's a big shift, and I think from what I'm seeing and hearing, I think property management's actually a really exciting place to be. It's just going to take everyone a year or two to get excited.
Yes, yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Wayne, I just want to thank you for joining us on the podcast, because it's been a great chat, everything from, you know, a bit of rock and roll to property management and real estate. If there was one thing that you'd like everyone to remember as a result of listening to all of those wonderful takeaways, what would it be?
For owners of business, the greatest management principle in the world is what gets rewarded gets done. So have incentive systems to really align with what you're wanting to do with your staff, what you want the business to achieve. Intelligent conversations, yeah, with the scripts, knowing what you're doing, and lots of them.
Yeah.
Just do that.
Good advice. Wayne Marriott, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Samantha.
To connect with all things Elite Agent, including the latest news, coaching and features, subscribe at our website, eliteagent.com.